welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. Tell me something. Have you ever wrestled with burnout?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Everybody's had moments. Writer's block. You just think like you're done. Can't do it anymore.
It's a horrible feeling, isn't it?
It really is. And I don't, it takes a while. I don't know if there's a magic answer other than to sort of rest and let it happen again. But
well, Lindsay has the magic answer.
Okay, good.
So that's what I'm looking for. I think most all working adults have experienced or are currently experiencing some kind of, you know, that sluggish malaise of burnout, you know, that times when our jeu de vie, our joy of life just feels stalled and all that feels is remaining is stress and anxiety, you know. Just recently, I myself am emerging from that nearly sort of paralyzing state of burnout. And for that reason, I am so much looking forward to our conversation today with my very favorite, one of my very favorite podcast guests, Lindsay Davis. Lindsay is a business and life coach for high performers. She lives in the success arena and fully understands that one of the greatest issues facing high performers is burnout. Now, since this show, I've kind of titled the show before we did it, but since this show is being first aired in late spring, I've titled it Spring Training. Yeah, baseball's in my mind. Spring Cleaning, Getting Rid of Things That Don't Work. I have so much to say, but instead, why don't we just bring on our voice of sanity on this subject, Lindsay Davis. Lindsay Davis, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. Thank you for having me. Once again, you guide the most interesting conversations, so I'm excited to be here. Not sure I'm the voice of sanity, but we'll see where we go today.
I know that was my next question. So what do you think about being titled the voice of sanity on this sometimes insane show?
Yeah, right?
So I describe you as the business and life coach for many elite and high-level performers. I know a lot of your clients, your coaching clients, are high-level performers. However, Lindsay, you yourself are an elite concert performer playing viola. Can you, you know, this is a pretty broad question, but can you tell me about your experience with burnout in the world of high achievers?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. It's a common one. It is a big topic and a big question, and I think there can be a number of reasons one is experiencing burnout. I always like to ask, what kind of burnout? And let's get a little more specific. But, you know, I think it can come from a number of reasons. One can be simply that whatever you've been doing, you don't want to do it anymore. Whatever question or drive that you had, like, that's been satisfied, and you're actually ready to close that chapter and open to your next venture, which I know you can appreciate, Charlie. And I think we can also have burnout from, you know, another source that I see commonly is, I think, the stuck accelerator pedal syndrome, which is kind of what got high performers or type A's or driven creatives, however we want to label, what got them there was generally a high level of grit and discipline and drive and desire and hunger. And yet at each new level of performance or challenge, that's going to start eventually getting in their way and start detracting from their ability to bring their A game or their performance and really bring their joy to what they're doing.
Don't you think it has something to do with trying to, you know, after you achieve a certain level of expertise or fame or reputation, that the joy of doing the job seems to be taken over with trying to live up to the expectation? And that trying to live up to the expectation, that's where the stress and pressure are found. I know when I was, as I was working with my coach, you know, our friend Kameen Samuel, and I was explaining to her, and she says, who is looking at your performance and saying that your performance is not good? Well, no one. Is anybody complaining that you are not performing? No. And it turns out, Lindsay, it's my expectations, my personal expectations. You know, I'm not faced with the crowds, you know, with the feedback from the crowds that is negative feedback, like a professional athlete or an elite concert performer or an artist might face. And what it really comes down to is it's my personal expectations. I have such high expectations for myself. And if I don't feel like I'm living up to those expectations, somehow I'm transferring those thoughts into think people are judging me. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It happens. And again, like, what got you here won't get you there, right? That old adage.
Oh, geez.
But it's, you know, there's something around, like, even if it's dysfunctional or been dysfunctional to be hard on ourselves, it served us in some way in our life. We got accolades for being an achiever, or we stayed out of the spotlight of getting in trouble, or whatever our early formed reasons were. But we carry that really harsh voice inside that once we start to make that voice our advocate versus our critic, and start even contemplating that shift, something I've noticed is, like, it's almost like that freaks out a high performer of who will I be without that? Will I lose my drive? Will I just stop achieving? Will I lose everything that I've worked this hard to do? Will everybody else pass me by? And it's sort of this weird answer and opportunity to hook up the source, the inner source of power or drive, to a different source rather than criticism.
You know, I've heard the story of, you know, I need to look up this artist's name because I quote this story a bit, and he was a famous contemporary artist of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and when he first started, he was in New York, and he was in one of those, you know, lower-level apartments that were almost half below ground, only a window was above ground. And he did all of his paintings, and he was only doing it listening to his muse, and his own creative juices were developing these paintings. And he just received incredible accolades for it. And then he talked about, for a number of years after that, he tried to reproduce those paintings rather than listening to that muse. And that in itself, to me, that can cause burnout because you're not living according to your nature. You know, you're getting praise, but you know it's just for the artist. I don't want to say it's garbage, but it's like not fake, but it's not, there's a lack of authenticity to it. And that seems to me that could cause, you know, I'm tired of this. This is not worth it. This is not what I'm built to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you find anything like that with your clients, with your high performers?
Totally. And I think the cultural or seems like one of the easy solutions that people commonly come to is that you have to have your art, and you have to have, like, your artwork or your love project, and you have to have your cash work. And so some people make the decision that they don't overlap. They keep them in separate boxes to try to keep that freedom or that pressure down. I don't think that that's the only solution, or that hasn't been my experience. But I do think it requires a high level of honesty to bring your artisan self, and it doesn't matter whether you're an athlete or an author or anything, but that artisan to really ask, like, what really drives me to explore? What do I want to express through my craft or my work? Like, where are my curiosities now? And maybe allow that those have shifted over the years. And I think it's interesting first for a conversation around, you know, our innate nature is curious, is engaged, is these little bundles of like driven desire. And we have that energy naturally as children in a healthy environment. And it seems like what starts to crowd that out is the cultural or inner expectations and who we have to be or think we have to, how we have to show up, what we should be interested in, what we should be creating, what we should be striving for, rather than the full permission to say, like, what do I want here? What am I interested in? And am I going to allow myself to move that direction? And there's a little bit of risk, sure.
I think of a couple of different things, and I think of Bob Dylan. And you remember when Bob Dylan had his, you know, Blowing with the Wind days and his guitar and harmonica, and he did that Newport concert on the East Coast. He completely changed his style, and he took with him the backup group, the band, and they did electric music. And he was nearly booed off the stage, and it wasn't just at Newport. Every time he tried to do a concert, he and the band, no one could accept it, yet that was Bob Dylan's creativity, of which we now love Bob Dylan's electric music. Mm-hmm. But he you know, fortunately listened to that voice inside and was able to, he had enough self-regard, evidently, that he could handle all of the negativity and the boos and the negative press, and just continue doing that. That's an artist doing what an artist has to do, and just saying, you know, if it's not going to fly, then I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that story. I was going to ask you, what did he do next? But he answered it.
He just, you know, that was when he did. I don't want to say the first one. I'm just going by personal recollection. This is not by reading. This is by an old guy who went through those times. And he came out with an album that had Lay Lady Delay. Do you remember that song?
Mm-hmm.
Was more electric. And it wasn't heavy electric, but it was more electric, and that just became super popular. And then after that, people accepted Bob Dylan for what they accepted Bob Dylan. But, you know, what we're looking for is a couple of things, and that's the regard of our accomplishments, and our accomplishments either financially or in accolades. And both of those, you know, I don't want to discount saying those are not important. You know, finance, you know, making money is important, mm-hmm. and getting recognition for your work is important. And if you're an artist, to have people not accept your art, you know, is a challenge, because it's coming from the deepest part of your soul, you know, when you're doing that, when you're not trying to repeat something you've done in the past. So it's negative voices inside you that say you're not performing like you're performing, and that is certainly grist for anxiety and stress.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and over time, right, that anxiety and stress sustained over time, the accelerator pedals down because you don't feel like you can take your foot off the gas. I mean, I think that's an inevitable. You wake up one day and you just don't feel it anymore, and you kind of lost what feels like you lost yourself along the way.
And then it just, and that, in, you know, a natural outcome of that is burnout. I just can't do this anymore. I'm just feeling oppressed. I feel like I have to produce this, and I have to get these things out. I don't want to get these things out because I just don't have the energy for it. You know, let's maybe perhaps kind of dive into, take a little sidetrack from this and dive into something that you and I chatted about briefly, but we really, I don't think, you know, and I looked at my notes and I don't think we really got into it deeply. How would you define burnout? I mean, I think we all kind of have a feeling of what it is that it has to do with stress and anxiety and just too much going on, our calendar's too full. But it's not so much our physical, even though our physical calendars impact us, it's our mental calendars that we don't have what we are going to talk about later in your beautiful phrase, float space. We don't have that internal space, and so we just have an internal checklist that we have to measure against, and it's a never-ending and never-gratifying checklist.
Yeah, and I think, remember we were talking about this in realm of productivity, being like productivity, kind of a tongue-in-cheek definition, like strategies for more tortured performance. You know, how can I make myself do the thing that I don't want to do anymore? Your question, like, how would I define burnout? I don't know. I'd probably define it differently.
Oh, good.
From
please.
The conversation.
But, yeah, please.
But, you know, what's coming to mind is if we take it to what you were saying, like on an internal level, like an energy level, for me, it's like disconnect or misalignment. They're like something's not connected to our source of joy or creativity or flow, like the muse, that we've allowed ourselves to be unplugged in some way, either from expectations or whatnot, or we're fundamentally misaligned with what we're doing.
That's why I like talking to you, Lindsay. No, it's beautiful. That's why I like talking to you, because I think that's so insightful in that it is a misalignment. And we are not connected with our muse or our deepest inner selves. And we are connected to false goals and false expectations that even if we accomplish them, we are not satisfied with it.
It's hollow.
You talk about something that I want to move to, obviously related, but another window through this. You talk quite a bit about float space. Rather than me try to define it, tell me about float space.
It's awesome. Float space for me is first of all a loving act of rebellion. And I love introducing it that way to people because it takes a little bit of gumption to go across the grain of expectations and what we think we can get away with. Float space, we could say on one level, is just unscheduled space to be. Now, I say that on one level because people will hear that as like self-care or time off. And I'm not discounting the value of those, but I'm like asking that we expand or deepen the definition. It's not about scheduling more self-care or sitting around twiddling our thumbs. And that's really tough to do when somebody has like intense drive and energy. But it's this unscheduled space that you create in your calendar or in your environment or your rhythm that's you doing whatever actually allows your well to refill. And not doing anything that drains it, including having no expectations of what you have to like get done from that space.
I love it.
You might call this like flow. You know, it's flow.
Yes, yes, that flow state. That. Now, in order to get to that flow state or float space, is it necessary? Is it sort of a replacing negative thoughts with, or negative intentions or negative drivers or negative feelings with, not replacing it with good things necessarily, but just removing those subtractions and letting good neighbors move into our neighborhood?
Yeah, maybe so. I haven't thought of it in that way. I kind of think of it as whatever that thing is that feels the closest for you of play, It doesn't have to mean like silly. That's not my version of play. You know, if you're normally a disciplined musician, it might still be music, but it might be just riffing on things or composing. It may be, you know, kinesthetic, meaning moving or athletics. But it's, I think the importance is like without expectations, without like, how am I doing? Am I recharging? Am I enjoying this? It's sort of like what I like about the float is you're following your innate curiosity and energy. And whether that means you sit and you just stare off into space and you just have this completely open nothing, or you're intensely focused on downhill skiing, but without any kind of performance expectations. I don't know, but it's, for me, that seems to be float space. Is that what you mean by good neighbors moving in?
Yeah, moving into your, you know, your mental neighborhood is yeah.
Yeah, in like internally creating inner stance of space.
Yes. We alcoholics have a statement that my brain is a neighborhood you don't want to come into. It's a dangerous it's a dangerous neighborhood, and we need to replace, you know, that neighborhood with a healthy neighborhood. There's
a couple goodness of and all creatives, right? That touch of melancholy. It's sort of like, yeah, that neighborhood's pretty scary and there's some pretty vicious voices in there.
Yeah, but that neighborhood is also, that neighborhood can also be the conduit for great health. Susan Cain has just written a book after Quiet. She's written a book titled Bittersweet on something like, I'm gonna screw up the subtitle, but it's on longing and sadness as sort of the root to self-fulfillment. And it's a very interesting thesis that she works through. Detachment. To get float space, part of the problem with float space and part of the problem with, you know, getting in touch with our inner core is that we become so attached to expectations, outcomes, one, and I know there's more than one that we need to detach from, outcomes, and the other is sort of this need to please others, including clients and bosses and whomever, that there's this need, but both of them are based on my performance, not based on my essence. My essence is very different than my performance. So I would like to talk a bit about, you know, this very difficult subject to talk about is detachment, which I am so keen on. It's probably my number one topic for this show, but I don't know how long we're going to spend on it. But it's sort of paradoxical, this thing of outcomes. You know, I'm thinking of my son playing baseball, and I was late for the show today because I was sitting in my car watching my son play baseball, and he got a hit, you know. So outcomes, you know, that makes a dad happy, and then a guy hit a home run after he got the hit, so they tied the game. And outcomes-oriented, and so athletes are certainly high performers that as musicians, you know, are in the public. We're so measured by our outcomes, and so many athletes, and I would assume artistic performers, and you know, that's in music and in dance and in theater, are interested in outcomes. And yet outcomes, I don't want to say they're not important, but they can, if we focus only on outcomes and not in the process, not in the internal process, mm-hmm. we can lead ourselves to this state of burnout.
Yeah. And, you know, early on, before we become a somebody in our field or a career or whatever, I feel like we give ourselves more permission to be in the process and to get lost in the process. And we naturally have less attachment at times to those outcomes because we love that process of mastery and exploration. and the stakes don't feel as high. And then you start getting, you know, like some of your stories, like you start getting those accolades, or you're in a bigger arena, and suddenly you become much more attached. Outcomes become much more important measures and metrics of how are you doing. And some of that is necessary. I don't know that we're going to get away from that fully.
Right, right. I agree.
We really want to.
Yeah, I totally agree.
For me, I see learning detachment is an internal skill, like developing a muscle that you're going to need to flex stronger at certain times than other times. And to be able to care so much on the front end, meaning you are putting your time in the practice studio, you're bringing your sincere effort and attention and like best. And then the moment you step out, whether it's step out on stage or step out on the field, you kind of have to forget it and tune out the crowd and tune out your inner critic and have it's almost the inner stance. It's so interesting. I haven't thought of it. The inner stance of like float space, but in that moment of performance.
Did you see the series on, I don't remember what platform it's on, but Mozart in the Jungle?
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Oh, mark it right now if you have a pencil or a pen. Mark it down. It's you've got to see it. I mean, it's just...
Mozart in the Jungle?
Mozart in the Jungle. I think it's three or four seasons, and it is absolutely brilliant. And it talks about, and what he's all about, you know, the director of the New York Symphony. He's sort of a radical young conductor, and he's all about not so much your outcomes are certainly important, but your outcomes are the result of your inner drivings of something that's very personal to you, and that you have this inner fire that you have to do this thing, and the outcome will be a natural result, a natural consequence of that. But if you're seeking these accolades, you move away from what is most natural and what is most delightful. It's a brilliant, brilliant series, and besides, it's funny as hell. It's Bernal Gabriel Garcia, I think, and he's a fabulous Mexican actor. That's a very, very good show. Let me tell a story. In working with Camille and working with my issues, just last week with. I was just feeling pressure of having to deliver a number of things. I was just kind of almost paralyzed, Lindsay. I didn't feel like I wanted to work on them. I would do distractions. The computer game Hearts became very important to me. I'm
always a good indicator.
Yeah, isn't it? You know, it's just okay, I think I'm gonna depart for just one game and then come back. And Camille suggested that I take a certain number of days off and do no productive work, think about no productive work, don't be in contact with anybody about it. And I took this longer time. It was a 4-day. When I say longer for a 1 week, for a 7-day week, and I took 4 days away. It was a cleansing. And then when I came back to work on Tuesday, when I came back in the morning on Tuesday, I went right back to that burnout stage. That told me, or feeling burned out, you know, feeling like I just don't want to do any of this stuff. That told me, that was the first indicator that I have indeed, I'm not going to say master, but I've adopted many of the necessary requirements for detachment. I was, during the time off, I was totally detached from my expectations, from what was on my to-do list. And I just totally enjoyed those days. Were such a release. I was done, and And I don't think I've ever, I know I've been working on detachment, but that was the clearest indication that I have the ability to detach and then fall right back into it, which was negative. But, you know, that whole conversion can work itself mm-hmm. out. But the important thing yeah, was in the detachment.
Nervous system.
Yeah. You know, the important thing was, how do we put this in detachment? You quit caring, and yet you don't quit caring. Isn't that a weird...
I would say I care so much, and in order to care so much, that means I'm bringing my optimal energy. And in order to bring my optimal energy, that means I've got to let my own well, my own energy refill.
So is this where we deal with is there something of subtraction in here that I'm subtracting those outside influences, those outside expectations, and getting away from those and just letting me relax and get into my core of who I am and breathe and contemplate and write like I would want to, just kind of freedom to write?
And I say maybe because we would explore, I think, deeper what of those expectations are internal, your voice, and how can we start to shift your relationship with that so that you have more space internally and with that inner drive. And then I think partly, is there any external drivers or circumstances where we can take a really literal stance of creating space, meaning having some conversations with people where there's deadlines or we've taken on too much, and be able to say, hey, look, I got to dial it back, or this is going to take me longer than I thought to put out. And you're actually creating space for yourself by speaking up and advocating from the deadline. Sometimes we forget to do that. Or, hey, I committed to this thing, but, I just don't have the bandwidth. And any part of us that feels horrible, like, we're letting people down and, you know, we're being flaky or whatever that voice is, like making peace with that. So too, like you said, tasks, I don't even like calling it that, I guess, activities that refill you, that truly refill and with no expectations. And yeah, I don't know if that answers your
question. Yeah, it does. It does. And I want to go to... you used a book illustration when we talk, and as everybody knows, I typically talk to my guests a few days before the show just so we're kind of on the same page. And you brought up a book that I said I didn't think I want to bring up the title of the book on the show, and I am decided to break all my rules. So listeners, we are going to use the word fuck. So just you know, I apologize if I offend some people, but it is the title of the book. And the book's title is The Art of Not Giving a Fuck. I seem to be very, very moved by the thesis of the book. Would you tell me what that was all about and why that was so important? Because I think that's what detachment is about. It's about developing the art of not giving a fuck to some degree. I mean, it's not totally, but, you know, but go ahead and explain it to me.
Yeah, so the title, you know, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, and it's by Mark Manson, who is a kind of maverick thought leader. But I really enjoy, you know, giving that book to some of my clients who are genuine, like, they are caring people. They care about, you know, current issues. And when I say care, they care, and they're also trying to put hands to it. Sensitive and aware and engaged with what's going on, and they're so internally driven in what they're doing. And what I liked in that book and totally agree with, but if we give a fuck about everything, every little thing, we might call that perfectionism, but, you know, I think he made the case, like, that's actually neuroticism.
Yes, it is.
To extremes.
It's insanity.
And it is, and we're diluting we're making our care be emotional chaos and a state of upset. Actually being able to choose your values and what you currently give a fuck about, whether that's in yourself, in your own process and performance, or with your family or loved ones, or, you know, socially or culturally or globally, but really choose on purpose. And then those are the things that you're giving your sincerest energy and attention to, rather than the variety of endless, ubiquitous other choices.
Yes.
That we can be obsessed about.
Yes, and it can overwhelm us. And
totally.
And so my conclusion is, I don't know if I can say it boils down to, but it certainly includes a matter of choice. And that if you deeply care, or if you give a fuck, you know, so I'll just say deeply care. If you deeply care about everything, you will burn out. You will reach, you will max your limit. So we must choose and narrow down what it is that we really care about. What do we really give a fuck about that makes a difference in our lives and in the lives of the people we love and the people we serve?
Yeah, and that's a really actionable thing for, you know, a listener, anybody to really sit down with a notebook in a quiet room, free of external influences, and just sit and ask themselves that, and notice how many times we're informed by others what we should care about.
Go to church.
Yep. Rather than really asking ourselves what's truly important for me most right now. And to realize that we can, there's kind of different levels of care, right? Like, I feel like we can care, have compassion, care about a situation, but we're not also applying our best energy and attention and action to that situation or environment or issue.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean we don't care. It means we care about these. This is where I'm making the biggest impact personally right now.
And that's what detachment is all about. If I become too attached, now I'm going to put it in the realm of coach and client. If I am too attached to my client, I can't serve my client. Because I think you're the one that brought up, I have a note here somewhere. Oh, here it is. How would it help the issue for me to be as upset as my client who is having the issue? Isn't it better for one of us to be calm? And if I allow myself to be so attached that I am into it as emotionally as my client, then I'm just part of the problem. I can't be a solution. I have to be able to see it from the outside, see it from a broader scope. And I think that's what detachment says. It doesn't mean we don't care. We care deeply, but it means that we are not attached to the immediate result. That is up to the client. And if I put my value system on how they respond to my interactions with them, and I can run too much a risk of being too emotionally involved.
Totally. You want a funny metaphor that'll clean this up forever?
I would love a funny metaphor that would clean this up forever.
Yeah. Think of being a first responder. So they come in, and my husband's been a first responder, so I appreciate this about him, but, you know, they come in when there's been an accident or something terrible is happening, and people are emotional, and understandably, and they're, you know, in this complete and utter, like, trauma state sometimes, you know, and do you want your first responder to be screaming and panicking and hyperventilating? Does that demonstrate that they care?
No, that demonstrates they're totally irresponsible.
I want them out. Like, get me a real first responder.
Or give me morphine that I don't have to pay attention to this person.
It's sort of like they are detached as a first responder. They're there because they care, right? And they're demonstrating their care by being clear-headed and setting their own emotional response on hold for a moment. And they do have to process that later, and that's another topic. But, you know, they're there to bring their best clarity and strategy and game to that situation because they care. And I find that that just, like, really clears it up, where I'm like, oh, that means that me being just as emotional or worked up, that's not a demonstration of how much I care or don't care. That's just an emotional being worked up. That's all.
I used to work with, when I would be a consultant for a longer period of time in a company, and I would frequently say 5 years is the max that I can work with you. Because after 5 years, I am so entrenched into the company ethos, the company problems, the personalities. I have maybe, it was just because of the days that I was not detached. I said, I really become part of the problem at this point. I'm just another voice coming out of the issues. I'm not separate. I'm not detached. I'm not far enough away. That I can give you an objective perspective on this, because I too am being influenced by the inner troubles. I want to talk about listening, but Paul's telling me we need to take a break. So I'm going to take a break, okay, and then we're going to come back and talk about listening, okay? Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with my very, very, very special guest and friend, Lindsay Davis. And we are talking about burnout, detachment, float space, trying to find that space that we are not so driven by outcome that it overwhelms or supersedes our internal core of artistic insight. And another thing Paul just reminded me that Lindsay, I didn't even realize that you and I get talking and we're still 15 minutes from now, or we started at 10 after. So we got 15 minutes. So you had mentioned something about listening, and that you're very into listening. Listening has been a key direction that I've been going in. And you talked about listening as an act of love, and listening is really an act of detachment in which you are loving, and you are not attempting to fix, but to give this person a sense that somebody identifies and somebody understands. And they almost don't need more than that.
Many times not. I mean, it's really, what if listening was giving somebody the space to have their own thoughts, to come to their own insights or moments of truth, to be able to make the choices that they need to or admit the things that they need to. I find that's a great way of creating space and an act of love. And it takes, I think, listening with more than just the ears, like learning to listen with like the whole body, and letting, you know, have me, myself, my issues and assumptions and definitions of words. Here, you have yours, and it's like these two worlds. Then there's like this beautiful space in between us where I can fully be curious about your world and wanting to see it and understand it from your perspective. And then ideally, in a two-way conversation, maybe not with like coach and client, but I'm also sharing my world. Right? And then we come to an understanding together.
Precisely.
I find that's a subtle but lost art. Do you find that?
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking, you know, Lindsay, 35 years ago, I was doing external training in a large oil company. I wasn't employed as a Chevron employee, but I was an external consultant trainer with Chevron. And we did Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which was, I think it came out in the late 80s. And one of his 7 habits was to develop the ability to listen with intent to understand as opposed to intent to respond. And I would add to that, our tendency is not to listen with intent to understand, but intent to respond and to fix. We have this...
So attached.
What's that?
We become so attached.
So attached that we want to fix. We want to be, okay, here's what you do. And instead of here's what you do, we instead ask a question that's going to hopefully give them insight that they can figure out what to do. And if they don't, I know my option, and it maybe is a cop-out, but I rarely give advice. I give options, opportunities. Have you thought about perhaps this or this or this? And let them decide rather than saying, this is what you need to do. Because with a coach, people will easily take, as soon as I say, this is what you need to do, they're going to go do. And that just scares me to death. Because what if they do it? And what do I know?
And even if you do have expertise, I mean, I know you have so much experience. Charlie is a consultant, and I think that's this beautiful space in a coaching relationship where you can pause for a moment. I'm going to overuse this, but create this space to ask permission and say, hey, normally I'm going to let you come to your own conclusions. I do have some experience in this arena, permission to be direct.
Yeah. And I did one of those just a couple of weeks ago, and I thought about it, and I was very comfortable with it. I felt like it was appropriate, but it is rare. It's on the rare side, and I think we both are blessed with our you know, I don't know, mentor, coach, friend, Kameen, who is one of the finest listeners in the world. That she will not talk until you are done talking. And then ask her, what do you think I should do? And all she does is ask a question. And you just, as soon as you ask her, what should I do? You start laughing because you know she's not going to tell you.
No, and I really love it if somehow we are in a space where she's sharing what she actually thinks. That's my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. She does do that. She does do that. So. Let's kind of sum it up. I'm thinking that burnout is having too many responsibilities and expectations, a lot of self expectations. We think we're driven by others, but we're trying to please others. So those are, they're closely tied to self expectations. Having so many of those that we cannot dwell in our truest and innermost self and take that time to do what we need to love to do. And I think another show that we should maybe in a month, because you know we could look at it, is that we could talk about how do you discover what is it you're hardwired to do. What is it that you feel you are created or ordained or DNA'd, whatever process we want to talk about? This is your truest inner core because burnout will disappear when we're behaving in line with our inner core.
Yeah, I would love that as a deeper conversation. And as big as a topic as it is, it's sort of like, think about stories from your past. Like, when did you feel the most alive? What were you doing? What were you not doing? What are those sparks where you feel curiosity or like something stirring, a deeper interest? You know, that, I mean, just even sitting with that question and thinking about stories from your past or crossroad moments or your proudest moments, they can kind of give you those clues. Now, it doesn't have to be that means that's your literal context of that's the only thing that's the expression of your truest self. I think we can be a little more creative than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been wanting to bring up this, and I and my fear is it may not relate, but I it does to me somewhere in the core, and maybe you can help me understand where it relates, and we'll wrap up with this. I just read Cal Newport's Deep Work. Are you familiar with his stuff on deep work?
I appreciate his perspective.
Yeah, and he talked about setting aside times, almost like Camille told me. You get rid of the crap, that the stuff that has to be done, you know, if it has to be done, it won't be done because it's not important enough to interfere with me doing deep thought work, deep research, deep writing, deep pondering. And, you know, maybe that's not for everybody, but for those, I know those creatives and those that are writers and musicians and ball players. My son will talk about that, you know, about his flow state and his creating, that he can't be depending only on outcome. He can only be depending on, is he doing his processes right? Is he doing his work right? And then the outcome will come. And if it doesn't come right away, don't worry about it. It will come. But I like that idea of deep work, and I think that's what I'm going to try to get to on my days off, is my deep work, and think about, like you said, what brings me the greatest joy, the greatest fulfillment, and at the end of the day, how I serve the planet best.
Yes.
Lindsay Davis,
yes.
You are... you know, as the audience could probably tell, you and I can do 2 and 3 hour conversations easily. And sometimes we do, until we just realize we've just covered life, the universe, and everything, and there's nothing left. But it's so much fun spending time with you today, and always such a grand pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlie. It's always a joy for me to be in conversation with you, and I appreciate the topics you choose for your show and how they come from your own life and what you're experiencing, and I think it leads to such a richer conversation, something that is lofty and deep and rich, but I think also has some really practical roots to it.
Oh my goodness! You just summarized what I try to do in a podcast. Thank you so much. That's very kind of you, Lindsay. We'll do something. We'll talk about something. I know you're a very, very busy woman, and so we'll talk about something in the future where we can talk about finding, you know, maybe discovering your passion, which is, my goodness, that's a 500-page book right there.
That is a fun conversation, and I know how to create space to have that with you. So.
Oh, yeah, that's why you're the coach. Okay, thank you, Lindsay, and I want to let everybody know that's all for today, and it is such a treasure for us serving you, our devoted listeners, and to let you know, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.